Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. My name's John Dewar. I'm the Provost of the University of Melbourne and your MC for this evening, your chair. Welcome to this third seminar in the series, Realising the National Vision for Tertiary Education. And the title of tonight's seminar is Australian Tertiary Education Under Reform, A Helicopter View of Progress and Speed Bumps. Professor Ross Garnaut, whom some of you might know, recently conducted a review of the university sector in Papua New Guinea. And he gave a talk here at the university a while ago about that review. And during the course of it, he mentioned that this was the first comprehensive review of the PNG university system for about 30 years. And in discussion, we noted that while that might be a long time between drinks, it's possibly better than the Australian alternative, in which we seem to have a review not just every time we change government, but almost every time we change minister within a government, which gives us an average of about every 3 years. We know that, at the very least, we'll have a minister in the next government who will be a different one from the chief architect of the current policy settings in the sector, because she, as you know, has moved on to a slightly different role. And even if there's a change in government, or particularly if there's a change in government, we'll have a coalition government that will undoubtedly seek to change the policy settings quite dramatically. But leaving all that aside, even on current policy settings, there's a lot for our speakers to get their teeth into tonight, whether from a helicopter vantage point or from the more grounded perspective of speed bumps. Now, adopting just very briefly a sort of quasi-Rumsfeldian classification of reform initiatives in the sector, we have the knowns but possibly not yet materialised, such as TEXA, compacts, reformed performance indicators, HEP, ERA, SRE, CRNs, and reviews of funding rates. And incidentally, if any of you are allergic to acronyms, then now's the time to leave the room. And then we have the possibly unexpected but materialised slightly more rapidly than we'd anticipated, such as the AQF. And then there's a completely non-Rumsfeldian category known as broken promises, into which falls something called indexation. Anyway, there's a very broad terrain confronting our speakers tonight, whether from that lofty viewpoint of the helicopter view or, as I say, the more grounded perspective of the road bump. And we're very fortunate to have two excellent speakers to help us chart the terrain. And what I'm going to do is introduce our first speaker, who will be Professor Peter Coldrake. And then when Peter's finished, I'll introduce our second speaker, Jim Davidson. And then we'll have a Q&A session at the conclusion. So Professor Peter Coldrake is our first speaker, and he's the Vice-Chancellor of the Queensland University of Technology, a position he's held since 2003. He was previously Deputy Vice-Chancellor in the same institution, and before that served for 4 years as Chair of the Queensland Public Sector Management Commission, a body established by the Goss government to overhaul Queensland's public sector. He's a dual Fulbright scholar, and amongst other things, worked as a senior scholar in the field of higher education policy and management in the early 2000s. And he's the author or editor of a number of books, including On the Brink, Australia's Universities Confronting Their Future, published by University of Queensland Press, and Academic Work in the 21st Century. In May 2009, he became chair of the Board of Universities Australia, which, as you know, is the peak body for Australia's universities. He's also a member of the board of another acronym, the OECD-IMHE, which is the Organisation for Economic Development, Institutional Management in Higher Education. So, ladies and gentlemen, please make a very warm welcome for Professor Peter Coldrake.
Thanks very much, John. I acknowledge Jim, who's going to be speaking later, my colleague Ian O'Connor, and friends all. I've actually decided not to have any PowerPoints. I've got to a point in my life where I don't like reading PowerPoints. I prefer PowerPoints which are visuals, but I actually had difficulty thinking about suitable visuals that might accompany this presentation that would be reasonable. If my remarks tonight are of a helicopter lofty nature, then attribute them please to UA, If I rant and am locally feral, you can refer to me as Vice Chancellor of QUT. Look, I'm just, I'll say a couple of contextual things, but I'm just going to talk about three things. I'm just going to talk about where we are with TEXA, and I don't wish to be too boring. Some of you will be intensely interested in the detail of this, and some of you may not. Secondly, I'm just going to say something about the intersection of TEXA, this acronym, with this other acronym, the AQF, which has been a very difficult issue for Universities Australia in recent times. And we had a seven-hour seminar or workshop at University of New South Wales on Monday of last week, and I have an attention span of about 2 hours, so I was deeply challenged, but it was an important day. And then the third thing I'd just like to talk about, all within about 20 minutes, are what I've called issues around the corner, which include issues which will confront any incoming government, whether it be of the same variety or a different variety. Whenever I think of our environment, the regulatory environment that prevails, I'm reminded of my time a long time ago living in Washington, D.C., when, as with new governments everywhere, particularly in our sector, people always call for more flexibility, allowing greater autonomy and all the rest of it. I remember Ronald Reagan came to Washington as an anti-Washington candidate and said that he was going to sort Washington out and he was going to get rid of all the unnecessary federal regulation. At the time, which was 1980, the code of federal regulations in the United States, if it was able to be consolidated, amounted to some 87,000 pages. After 8 years of great work in which he attacked all the regulatory overload in that country, the code of federal regulations amounted to 150,000 pages. I'm glad he was against regulation, because goodness knows what would have occurred if he hadn't been. I think we all have a fairly good sense here of what the main elements of the recommendations of Bradley are, because, of course, they're underpinning that which is currently happening. We also, I think, have a good sense of what came before, the fact that we had a system based on educational profiles, on the one hand accompanied by AUQA, and on the other, state regulation, particularly state responsibility for accrediting new providers and for monitoring standards. Well, we also know that post-Bradley, we've had given to us very obvious evidence of the failure in our own system, a failure of regulation, but a failure associated with the way in which federal responsibilities for immigration have meshed with responsibilities at the state level for new providers, particularly how that issue has been seen through the prism of the Indian student crisis. But that sort of issue hasn't been around, and indeed, toward the end of my remarks, one of the issues for the next government will obviously be to consider just what's going on in the international arena. So I'm not going to say much about the historical context, because I think people here know the various phases we've been through as a country, the movement, through the quality process, the embracing of AUQA, what happened in the period 1995 to 2005, when the only real additions to Commonwealth investment, the only real additions to higher education funding were contributed to by the students, although Nelson did, of course, introduce some changes, did introduce 2.5 by 3 from 06 to 08. I think we can take that as settled territory. I'll move to the first of the three issues and just say something about TEXA and where we are. There's been a lot of noise about TEXA over the last number of months, particularly the pace which was being pursued by government, which was seen to be indecent, although perhaps there was an imperative here to get reform done. I remember in an earlier time in my life, as was mentioned by John, I chaired the public sector reform activities in Queensland. And I remember Wayne Goss saying to me, you can get elected on a reform platform, but you're never going to be re-elected on it. So get whatever you can done in the first 3 years, because nothing's going to happen thereafter. And so we went for broke. Glenn Davis was a fellow traveller. And we were all extremely popular individuals in the Queensland public sector during that time, as you can imagine. But in terms of what's been going on with TEXA, I think the government, the Deputy Prime Minister, as she then was, has listened. The Secretary of the Department, Lisa Paul, has listened. And there's been some good engagement with government in recent times. I think that a lot of the major issues around governance, certainly careful plating and around timetable, and about the need for a common sense, if you like, proportionate response to some of the issues. There's been some progress too. We've now got an interim chair, Denise Bradley, and we've got an interim CEO, Ian Hawke, who is a person who's got experience of the state government, being an assistant director general in Queensland, therefore knows the McTee scene. He also has quite an intimate knowledge of the vet sector. Indeed, one vice chancellor said to me he was very concerned about Ian Hawke because he was a vet man. I don't think Ian's ever worked in the vet sector, but he actually has a knowledge of the vet system. The things that are really coming through now, we don't have legislation yet, and of course we will need an act. We haven't seen an exposure draft, but the then Deputy Prime Minister has indicated that there will be one provided, and that's very useful. Know everything that will be in the Act, but we can pretty well assume that it will relate to heads of power of registration of providers and the conditions of registration and the power to accredit courses for non-providers. The standards, which have been the subject of much consternation, won't be in the legislation, but of course they will be in regulation in the so-called disallowable instruments. And the government has indicated that there will be five sets of standards. In terms of progressing the matters around McTee, a lot of concerns have been around how these matters have progressed with McTee or in the McTee framework. And McTee has set up principles, one of which is dealing specifically with the matter of regulation and quality, and it will be chaired by the Federal Minister or the Deputy Secretary in the Federal Minister's absence, and of course include representatives from each of the states, as well as four outsiders, including the position by Chair of UA. The government has been considering a commission model. It hasn't sort of settled the nature of that commission model, other than language around a combination of part and full-time commissioners. And of course, have an aspiration, which we think it is very important to achieve, to try and bring TEXA and the vet regulator together by 2018. I think that will be a very hard ask indeed. UA's position is that we support a single national regulator full stop. We recognise the challenge involved in states. We also know, on the other hand, that the Commonwealth can deal with the universities, either the corporation. With regard to the important the intersection of the qualifications framework and TEXA, UA has a position which sort of is structurally a little untenable, which I think is politically worth pursuing, and that is that we underneath the umbrella of TEXA. I recognise that there are some issues raised by that, but at the end of the day, we've got to have a system that's understandable and broadly digestible. That which of failures would not able to be accommodated unless McTee were of a view to do so, and it is far from clear whether McTee would be of such a view. But nevertheless, we have to deal with that. We know that the government's proposing five standards, the provider standards, the teaching and learning related, the research, the communications and the qualification standards. A lot of the issues and a lot of the noise has been around. And I think that we will probably see post-election a draft set of provider standards or a draft provider standard issued to us for comment. There is no intention by government, and I assume no intention by any alternative government, to change any of the protocols that we're operating under. The teaching and learning standards presumably will emerge from the work of ALTC and the DVCA's performance indicators and so on. The research standard, so far, ERA is running its course, Excellence in Research in Australia, but I think we probably need to be a bit careful about ERA being a proxy for research standards. And in reality, some existing players might not make the grade if that were the case. I also note that the government hasn't endorsed the Bradley recommendation that each university needs to have research proficiency in three areas. That's a relevant aside in terms of that discussion. The responsibility for developing the research standard is one jointly of DISA and DIWA, the two relevant departments, but the outcome of the election either way could affect that. There is often overlooked, but is actually very important in terms of Texas obligations to report on performance, and finally the qualifications standard, where the government has asked the AQFC to work on this, remembering the comments I've made already, and I'll come to that in a moment. At this stage, we don't know the exact linkages between standards. The exact nature of the linkages amongst the standards. We don't really know from what I said about how ERA might intersect. We are awaiting exposure drafts in respect of the provider standards, and I think the government has, internally within the department, has completed work on the comment, which will be very important for us, but we're not likely to see that this side of an election outcome. So that's all we sort of know on where TEXA is. People complain about the progress that's been made. I think if you look at the difficulties that were being encountered earlier in the year, look at the government's response to those, I think in the next couple of months, either way, we're likely to see some significant progress. The second issue I just wanted to make comment on is this intersection between TEXA and AQF. Like many vice chancellors, much to my great shame, I had not actually spent a lot of time in my life knowing anything about AQF until relatively recently. In fact, I got a text message from Denise Bradley as a result of the seminar on Monday of last week, in which I, as a result of it, I wrote a letter to Dawkins and copied her as a courtesy as the interim chair. And she said, I had no idea you could actually deal with such detail. I'm sure she meant it in a very nice way. And neither did I, and some of it may well be of a short-term nature. When we actually had that seminar, though, I actually said to the group, look, I think we ought to be really careful of the end game here, because while it might be difficult to agree on all the issues that we're debating, if we actually don't agree on a fair number of them, everyone's just going to drive straight through us. And part of the, and you might underestimate it, but part of the challenge has actually been keeping everyone in the room. And let me tell you, on issues as hot as JD, keeping everyone in the room has itself been quite challenging. The other reality I think we need to just bear in mind is that while we get engrossed in all the issues attached to universities, if you're in a governmental position and you're looking at this set of challenges, most of your nightmares are in the vet sector. So the universities are relatively, defined. Government can define the issues it wants to be worried about, but the things that will really curse them are really on the vet sector, and that's, of course, where a lot of the issues have arisen because of the wish to diversify the sector, which has basically meant letting people in as private providers and paying the consequences later, something that the Americans are now doing because the Americans are moving so quickly into Asia and some of the practices attached to good American institutions in Asia, particularly in China, are quite concerning. Our substantive concerns Universities Australia's substantive concerns about the TEXA-AQF thing have firstly been AQF, under the chairmanship of John Dawkins, racing ahead of the regulatory pace and trying to lock things in before the regulatory arrangements caught up. And that seemed to be a very dangerous place to be. Second, as a group, we wish to reinforce the research doctorate, the position of research doctorates, the so-called AQF level 10. We've had to deal with the master's issues around JD. That's been complex, and I think a criticism from some quarters is that we've lost our bottle a bit on that. I'm not so sure. I think we'll see what the plenary that we're holding on the 20th or 21st of September, which is being held at University of Melbourne, incidentally, comes up with. But I think we've defined those issues reasonably well. There's certainly an agreed position in respect of a lot of less important matters, but less important matters around credit transfer and, approval stamps on test aimers and things like that. But a couple of things about this whole AQF TEXA issue. We just better be careful that however it ends up, we don't find ourselves in the same muddle with doctoral qualifications that we have with master's qualifications, which are, for a whole range of historical and current reasons, a mess in funding and policy and practice terms. Not that I have a strong view. And the second thing is, by way of caution, directed as much to people like me prior to becoming so engaged with this issue, we have had an AQF since 1995. It's been introduced or endorsed or re-endorsed by both sides of politics. It was introduced at a time when Australia was seen to be a leader in providing such an initiative internationally. From a political perspective, it's all about pathways, recognition, mobility, mapping us in an international environment. And I don't see it going away, even though some of my distinguished colleagues think that it ought to go away. It's just not that's just a slightly delusional position in my view. So compliance with the AQF is a long-standing requirement and it's not likely to go away. So it's a way in which these sorts of apparati or apparatuses, if you take the Clyde Cameron view of the plural, can coexist. The last set of things I wanted to say, and I'll be fairly brief, are the issues that are around the corner. Let's just talk about them in some order. The possibility, firstly, of a change of government. We're at a slightly interesting stage of our political cycle. So what could happen if there's a change of government? The comments I make, largely based on my reading of speeches that Brett Mason in particular has provided in recent times, perhaps the best of them in giving detail was the senior staff forum of IIU on the 9th of July. I also talk quite a lot to him. We have the advantageous position of living in the same street of the same city. The first encouraging thing to say, and it's something we've been really talking to him about for a long time, is since when was nation building through education a partisan activity? Surely we should be careful about where we arrive at fault lines here. Let the fault lines be around the way we get there, but let the fault lines not be around the importance of the endeavour, both economically, socially, or any other building block way. And that's certainly publicly endorsed now by the LNP, or the Liberal Party as it's otherwise called, and that's encouraging. I note that the indexation legislation a few weeks ago went through the Senate without opposition from the opposition parties, which also was good. So let the differences be around the way of getting there. More specifically, the Coalition on the Record has welcomed the Bradley Review. It has accepted the widening participation agenda, including the 25 to 34-year-old 40% target and the 20% low SES target. It's welcomed the shift to a demand-driven environment in a global way. It has said yes to compacts for goal setting and accountability. It has said to no to compacts if compacts are used to micromanage, and has said no to compacts if compacts are used to limit the aspirations for people who don't know their place. I assume my institution would be one of those, and so would Ian O'Connor's. Fourth, the opposition has expressed a view that the government's approach to supplier places is misguided, and they've really only said beyond that, that this is all about building aspiration from the primary school levels up, and I think most of us would agree with that. With regard to TEXA more specifically, they've said yes to a national regulatory agency. They've expressed some caution about the governance powers of TEXA. They've expressed caution in respect of the uncluttering of federal-state power issues, not surprisingly. We would also agree with the position, and I think government does too, that we do not want TEXA and AQF in a rivalrous position. They've expressed caution really around the quality assurance system more generally because of the view, understandable and supported, that not all institutions should look alike. So in terms of issues around the corner, I think the elephant in the room is obviously the possibility that the coalition could win the election. There are a number of others, the first of which I've mentioned already, the master's coursework funding and policy imbroglio, issues around CSP and fee help. I might say confounded by a lot of people in this room, because you come from the University of Melbourne, a lot of you, because a lot of the agenda is really related to some concerns which have derived from this town, but are much more broader than that. The indexation is a second issue. I know vice-chancellors are often seen as rent seekers. Well, we also try and balance our books. I mentioned that the government's legislation had been supported in the Senate recently in respect of the new indexation, and people are happy, of course, about that. The new indexation, and I'm going to read these notes because I've actually only captured them this afternoon. The new indexation arrangement, I did know this, is based on that professional and scientific, that ABS scale. The latest index data that's come through under that scale was previously from March to March, it looked like about 5%. It's gone down to 2.9% from the current March to March calculation. Why is that causing concern to everyone? Because most people have got salary increases about 4% a year to meet. And our index is based on, how could you actually work this out? On 3/4 of 90% of the above index plus 1/4 of the CPI movement. So I've got that, I think, correct. But our indexation for 2011 looks to be about 2.5%. Also, the government's holding back the performance funding, which resembles previous government sort of behaviour. I'm not too worried about that. I mean, I think if institutions individually are doing their jobs, they're going to get their performance funding. Nonetheless, if you get your worry about that, you can certainly do that. And I think politically, our position, of course, is that we would like for the indexation in any year, to reflect actual movements in salaries which universities are incurring. We've got to ourselves deal with this, because there'll be a tussle between high principle in the long term versus the stark realities attached to the 2011 budget, which looks like a reasonably rugged one in a lot of institutions, not least because of one of the other factors I'm going to mention, which is obviously the international outlook, which is deteriorating. There are various figures and discussions about this, and probably a number of people in this room who know much more about that. It's a particular issue for institutions. Some institutions them to make their own views, but the data that's I think that a lot of institutions have got some serious challenges to deal with. The other things around the corner are obviously the period of vulnerability we're in. We're in a period of real vulnerability if dodgy operators are trying to get basically registration to operate in the next year or two, and we don't have our national system sorted. This is obvious as hell. You can see it in the behaviour of certain players, particularly in the state of South Australia, without being too particular about it. Though I'm happy to be particular about it. But that's some clue. Not only South Australia. In fact, some who don't manage to get supported in one jurisdiction hop to another jurisdiction to have a go. Well, I just think that's a real period for vulnerability for the sector. I know the sector might be portrayed as behaving like medical specialists trying to control the flow. I think most people are not too worried about new providers entering the system, but I think people are very determined and concerned if new providers come into the system before we have the national framework in place. And given the data, given the various data in terms of unmet demand or otherwise and everything else, I don't think there's a need to hurry on that. Another concern that I think is out there is really the sustainability long-term of an uncapped system. I'm not venturing a view there. I'm just saying that this must be an issue which must be taken in conjunction, of course, with any forthcoming review of base funding levels and the increased costs that universities will have. So we've got an issue of the volume, students and the base funding. And those of you who are economists can run rings around me on this sort of issue, but it's clearly a matter that's going to attract some debate. The opposition has not said anything about full fee-paying arrangements, because I presume it's difficult for a full fee-paying domestic arrangement to coexist with an uncapped system. But what, therefore, might you do? So I'm simply saying that that's a bit of realpolitik we might need to deal with. The second last issue, I'll just mention monosyllabically almost, is a whole challenge around our retirements. I mean, my institution has, for 5 years, worked incredibly hard to try and, now I'm speaking as QUT Vice-Chancellor, of course, to regenerate the academic population as well as to build capacity at the professorial level. We've given ourselves a target in order to get where we want to get, to try and attract by 2015 or 16, 500 typically new young, newly minted PhD type folk. We've got about 150 in now. We're about to advertise 50 more. People say, where is the money coming from? The money is coming because we need to have that central pump priming and to give incentives for faculties to plan their retirements. You only have to look at the data and the age structures to know you have the people who will move through. So why wait until they're actually going to do it? Why don't you actually start planning with those folk? The issue just haunts me, and it must haunt other folk as well. We've been doing it for 5 years, and we're only just slightly younger than we were 5 years ago, but at least we are younger. And the very last thing, by way of summary point, I think the challenge is to bring the whole show together. When you've got a regulatory and reform agenda as complex as we currently have, and inevitably it's a complex business involving human beings and money, there are a lot of elements to be brought together here. And I do think that the next term of government, whoever is in office, will have an interesting time. Thank you.
Peter, thank you very much. Now, as I said at the beginning, what I'll do now is introduce our second speaker, and then we'll have a question and answer session at the conclusion of Jim's talk. Our second speaker is Jim Davidson. Jim is a principal in the NAS Consulting Group's Strategy and Public Policy Group, a role he started in May of this year. That followed a 12-month period as the managing director of TVET, which is Australia's leading organisational transformation of this ministerial company. Prior to that position, Jim was the first Deputy Secretary for Tertiary Youth and International in DEWA, where he was a strong advocate and supporter of tertiary education in Australia and led the budget negotiations following the Bradley Review. Jim has more than 30 years' experience in the public sector with the Australian, Victorian and South Australian governments, and holds a Bachelor of Arts with honours, a Master's degree in Social Administration and a graduate diploma in Applied Science Social Statistics. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jim Davidson.
Thanks, John. Like Peter, I thought about whether I'd have PowerPoints or not, and I just made the opposite decision. So I'll spare you some of me talking, and if it comes up on the screen as written text, I'm not going to repeat it to you, so take the opportunity to read it. I thought I should start with the pictorial, though. It was the only one I could get in time, Peter, for the event. And you'll notice the French flag at the end, so I'm not sure it really relates to the Australian higher education system, but the French one's in about as much turmoil as the Australian one at the moment. let me start here, because I will do a little bit of history, because I'm not sure everybody all does know the history. In 2007, doesn't seem that long ago, the present federal government was elected promising an education revolution, and particularly in the schools area. But it had a muddled and internally inconsistent policy in the vet space, and it had virtually no higher education policy. The higher education policy consisted of five disconnected initiatives, and they're all up on the screen for you to have a look at and reminisce about. But you could say it's not really an expansive policy setting that they came to government with. And I suppose in common with what Peter said, I think the most significant of these policies was the phasing out of the domestic undergraduate fee-paying courses, which remains, and I think will continue to remain, a key source of potential revenue for Australian tertiary providers, and therefore will continue to be at the centre of the policy debate. Coalition policy, and you know, I'm quoting from Christopher Pyne with Campus Review, and that's one of the problems of dealing with a coalition at the moment. There are three spokespeople. Seems to suggest a potential return to this policy, though its place in a demand-driven higher education policy is quite unclear. But in pursuing its vocational education and training objectives, and I'm going to switch between the two, the federal government included vocational education as one of the key areas within, I don't know if you all remember it, the productivity agenda of COAC, thereby continuing the shared responsibility model for vocational education and a reliance on state administrations to plan and deliver against two specific targets. And they are the number of higher education completions at high, you know, diploma and advanced diploma level, and I'll put them up later, and the proportion of Australians with a Certificate 3 or above. And in large part, the government has sought to implement this agenda through its Skilling Australia for the Future initiative, and specifically a scheme called the Productivity Places Scheme. Many of you who are just university-centric probably don't deal with these issues, but those of you who are kind of working across both sectors will know this is a fraught area. Victoria, however, is the notable exception to this purchase place model, negotiating a separate deal for its vet funding based on a demand-driven approach to vet funding, including student access to vet fee help for government-funded places. In the most recent federal budget, the offer of access to vet fee help has been extended to other states wishing to become reform states, and several states appear likely to take up this offer, one of which will be South Australia. In higher education, the then new Minister for Education established in 2008 a review of Australian higher education conducted by a four-person panel chaired by Denise Bradley, who we all have known to sort of come to know and respect. But, you know, this was essentially the task it was given. And I suppose the key point for me is the last four words, options for ongoing reform. And I think in part some of that flavour has got lost along the way. But what the review of higher education did do was that it provided the opportunity for a systemic analysis and reform of the sector. And more importantly, it provided a policy framework from which the government crafted a tertiary education policy, given that it didn't have one when it came to office. And one theme given to the review was establishing the place of higher education in the broad education sector, especially in building the integrated relationship with vocational education and training. And it's against this particular lens that I want to frame many of my comments tonight. And in so doing, I want to pick up a number of the key elements of reform proposals from the committee and the subsequent decisions of the government. So, diverse, high-performing institutions with a global focus was the second of seven themes that was given to the committee. And if I try to juggle that around and turn it into some kind of outcome statement, I might say something like, a high-quality system comparable to the best in the OECD in terms of success in learning outcomes. How then might progress to date be assessed? And during 2009, the OECD's Centre for Educational Research and Innovation actually reported on the outcomes of a multi-country review of systemic innovation in education. And for many people, I think this review, which is quite important, has slipped under the radar. And it put forward a particular model, and it's not particularly unique, and I just put it up. But it essentially, I think, creates a bit of the framework Peter was talking about. You can put this innovation in place, but you actually have to track it, make it happen, and assess whether, in fact, it delivers the kinds of results that we want. And they describe systemic innovation as any kind of dynamic system-wide change that is intended to add value to the educational processes. In a presentation I did to the OECD last year, providing commentary on their draft report, I drew the following key learnings for Australia from the three case studies that were done here. And this, I will actually speak to this one. The first one, innovation works best where states and territories and the Commonwealth can agree. And I think this is a lesson which has been well established within the Australian Federation and needs to be learnt over and over again. Secondly, the obvious one. If you're going to put in a set of funding approaches, they need to exist for a longer term and allow ownership and innovation to exist within that framework. And then the obvious one, it requires monitoring and evaluation. The fourth one that I'd add is essentially about systemic innovation, and I think this is absolutely critical in Australia, and I suppose part of the reason I moved from the state of Victoria to the Commonwealth, and that is it requires strong leadership and ownership from the Commonwealth. The Australian systemic innovation case studies undertaken by the OECD indicated poor performance in the areas of monitoring and evaluation. What it said, frankly, was that initiatives are often established based on sound policy settings, but they're often never evaluated properly or indeed followed through at all. And I think what Peter's suggesting is that we sit at the cusp of that very situation again. And I suppose my proposition is that we again run the risk in 2010 that many of the initiatives from the government's response to the review that were deferred to the outer years are at risk. And just to give you a list of those, so you kind of think that this doesn't mean very much, in fact it means almost everything. Basically, all of the substantial reforms in the higher education sector, most of the money, most of the initiatives actually are funded in the outer years. Peter's talked about the indexation, but there are a whole series of other things. The opposition has already indicated it may exempt some institutions, notably the GO8 universities from TEXA, and that it might even put a 12-month moratorium on the implementation of TEXA. So just going forward, I want to make some comments against four key points, and some of these I'll touch on, some of the issues around TEXA that Peter's touched on, but I want to also pick up a couple of other issues. Productivity and participation. The Australian government has set separate but not mutually exclusive targets for higher education and VET. The Bradley Review's targets were specifically higher education targets, and no link was drawn to the VET, COAG VET targets at all. By adopting separate targets, no real guidance has been given to the sectors on a clear outcome for Australian participation in tertiary education. So you sit there with these four targets, but actually what do they mean cumulatively? You know, do we know as a sector, and what might we might do about doing that? So I think for both sectors, the simple message that's come out has been that growth in participation, and for the VET providers specifically, in those areas of the AQF with both sectors, are able to offer qualifications, i.e. around the diplomas, advanced diplomas, associate degrees, and pathways to those qualifications into degree level is essentially where the growth is focused. So as we heard at the last seminar, there's an active process of both rivalry and collaboration occurring amongst the institutions in these sectors. This includes VET institutions increasingly seeking to offer higher education qualifications or pathways or guarantees from VET to higher education. There has been little or no active discussion about the governance of the sector or changes to the qualifications framework, and I'll stray into some of the territory that Peter's covered as well. So I think what we have on the positive side is a competitive market amongst institutions that is developing. But I think what we are missing at the same time is an active consideration of the governance of the system by the owners of the principal institutions, and by that I mean state governments. And I think this is a really noticeable absence. But I think two states in particular, and I'll name them as well, Peter, that is Queensland and Victoria, hold out the prospect of some early governance reforms to ensure strong, vibrant, publicly owned tertiary institutions, which can offer coherent pathways and opportunities across the state. And I think for those of us who are based in Victoria, I think we're all awaiting the Victorian government's tertiary education plan with some anticipation, particularly given its policy on demand-driven funding for both VET and higher education. So it creates quite a unique setting for Victoria, and you will have seen, those of you who read the various kinds of higher education reviews and campus reviews, the positioning that is going on at the moment. To increase demand from rural and outer metropolitan students will require governments to think through governance, pathways, And I think something I'm going to take from something Glenn Davis said a little while ago, a couple of years ago, a single consistent set of sub-degree qualifications for vet graduates that would allow students to upgrade their skills locally before moving on to higher education. From my point of view, the failure of the Australian government to release the report of the AQFC is puzzling, given that the policy position taken on this will be critical to increasing the underrepresentation of outer metropolitan and regional people and ensure that that higher education provision is sustainable and cost-effective as we move forward. So I concur with many of Peter's comments, but maybe I come at it a slightly different point of view around the AQFC. In terms of enhanced quality and standards, I think the key message that really came out of the Higher Education Review is that in a competitive market framework, it is important that all participating organisations are able to demonstrate that they meet the quality requirements expected. Entry to the market, or at least continuing participation, should have requirements to be tested by an independent market regulator, hence the proposal for TEXA and the abolition and absorption of ALQA. While any private higher education provider or publicly owned entity seeking to provide higher education must meet the nationally agreed protocols for higher education as they are implemented in different ways, in different state jurisdictions, universities have been exempt from those requirements. The review argued the case for a single national regulator for all higher education providers, and this recommendation was adopted by the Australian government with its decision to establish and fund TEXA by 2010 was the target. And contrary to your view, Peter, I'd say progress with TEXA, from my point of view, has been interminably slow, despite the fact that the Australian government could simply use its funding power for universities to introduce the quality requirements for all universities and all organisations in receipt of Australian government funding at a really early stage. The kind of complications that have come up have included the decision of Western Australia and Victoria not to agree to a national regulatory framework across the tertiary sector, emerging obfuscation from some state jurisdictions around the ability of the Commonwealth to regulate some higher education provided by not-for-profit entities, such as Bible colleges, attempts to be exempted by some market participants, and the confusion from the decision to establish and fund two separate national regulatory bodies, one for higher education and one for vet. While the recent announcement by Minister Crean of the chairs and acting CEOs of the two national regulators is welcome, it may prove to be too little too late. One gets great hope from the two eminent and innovative chairs, but this in itself may not overcome the difficulties inherent in a system which has been too long in its gestation and is still plagued by intergovernmental disagreements. In terms of global focus, I think there are some extremely welcome signs that DEWA, as the responsible Australian government entity, is again pursuing a coordinated tertiary approach, something that went missing as it grappled with the Australian government's self-induced collapsing of the international education system. It is still not clear what the intention of the Australian government is in relation to the future of regulation under the ESOS Act and the related legislation in each of the states and territories. As much as a single coherent regulatory environment is critical to underpin the domestic market, it is absolutely vital for the international student market. A coherent regulatory environment requires the implementation of the Bradley recommendation to move the regulation of tertiary providers to international students into the responsibilities of at least the two national regulators and preferably into one single national regulator. So I just put up, this is a slide that was done by my colleague Mark Burford when he was doing some work for me when I was still at DEWA, trying to look at the kind of regulatory environment which exists for providers trying to work within the higher education system. He's actually done a really good job of trying to make it look organised and sensible, but it's obvious, isn't it, the complexity of that model. To my mind, and picking up, I think, where Peter was heading, the efficient operation of Australian tertiary sector demands that all providers, whether higher education or vet, domestic or internationally focused, can operate under one singular, coherent national regulator with a consistent accreditation process. Providers of all sizes must be subject to the same requirements, but with recognition of the risks associated with providers in different market segments, different scales of operation, governance structures and histories. The failure of Australian governments to resolve the issues of quality and regulation in a nationally consistent way and to be diverted from this by both regulatory failure in relation to international education, the acquisitiveness of some providers of education to international students, and changes in Australian migration policies has been the spectacular failure of the implementation of the reforms and the most significant financial challenge to providers in the industry. Turning now just to the fourth point I put up, underpinning social inclusion. For VET at least, since 2003, and this is relative to all students, there has been little improvement in the proportion of students in the equity groups participating in VET. There has been only a marginal increase in the load pass rate during that period. But when you go a bit deeper and you look more closely at the level of qualification that these groups are taking, you see an even starker picture. Nearly two-thirds of students are in the lower level qualifications, which have poorer employment outcomes and fewer pathways into higher level qualifications. Some of these lower level and non-AQF qualifications may well be in literacy and foundation skills, but it's hard to believe there also isn't quite a good deal of churn. And when, on top of that, you look at the employment and education outcomes, you can see that for Indigenous students and those with a disability, the outcomes are 11% and 15% respectively below other VET students. So for those people who think VET is the answer to equity, it's not. You know, I think there's a very clear message here that VET has got its own problems and it's certainly not the answer for the sector. So one of the key questions for the Higher Education Review was how to extend access into the higher education system to groups who were generally not included. In higher education, this has been measured by the proxy data for participation for lower socioeconomic groups. And what did the data show? And this is the only table I graph I want, and I apologise for the poor quality. This comes out of the review report. And I noticed there was a comment in last week's, I think, Campus Review saying about 12 institutions that already hit the target. In fact, almost 12, I think it is 12 institutions that already hit the target at the time the report was introduced. I heard two parallel and somewhat conflicting messages from the tertiary sector during this period of the Higher Education Review, and particularly in terms of the discussions we had with the various kind of representative bodies in the period afterwards. And I tried to characterise them in two ways. The first was that universities, and particularly our top universities, are really for the best and the brightest students as determined by their enter score. They were already in high demand and overcrowded and really should be focused on research and innovation because this was their way to support the economic progress of Australia. They already had scholarships and other programs for the bright students from poorer backgrounds, and that was their contribution. The second was that when students did get into higher education, if they could be assisted to get through the first year successfully, their subsequent progress and educational outcome was on a par with other students. Put simply, it was not the enter score, or whether they'd come through VET or were members of a particular group or background. It was the amount of resources and effort that was applied to assist them in the first year that was the critical factor. Denise Bradley and her fellow members of the review team put great store in their report on increasing the proportion of students from disadvantaged groups who get into university. And to my mind, this is one of the more significant aspects of the report, and the most significant of the subsequent budgetary decisions to follow it. The Australian government adopted the target recommended, and in the first year of the budget package committed some $437 million, of which $136 million was to go in the first 2 years, towards the achievement of the target, and a most significant change in the targeting of student income support. And I think, don't think we should lose sight of the changes around student income support, because they are the most significant changes in a long time. So, to my mind, the Higher Education Participation Partnership Program is both a reward program and payment to institutions that are already achieving the target and an incentive to others to try and achieve it. And the proof, anecdotally, of course, at this stage, let me draw your attention to an article in The Age on the 9th of October 2009. It's very Victorian-centric, Peter, so you'll be... And there are two particular comments about our two GO8 universities. So the article was about Monash considers a selection overhaul. So this was the quote from the then Monash Vice-Chancellor. And so you're actually really starting to see a change, I believe, in the kind of approach. The journalist actually went on to say, Monash's decision to rethink the way students are selected comes after The Age revealed its crosstown rival, Melbourne University, was doing the same. Is competition the driver of change in education and training, or is it a passion for social equity? I'll leave that for you to decide. I think in this case, strategy has been backed by clear targets of what we want to achieve, and these appear to be having significant impacts on provider behaviour and significant rewards going to some providers. So in conclusion, the review of higher education enabled a government without a coherent higher education or VET strategy to develop a reform agenda. The budget statement of May 2009 provided a significant framework and an investment strategy to develop a demand-responsive higher education sector which operated within a single regulatory framework and had the potential to extend across the entire tertiary sector. The government's decision in the subsequent 2010 budget to extend the current arrangements in VET to all other states and territories and the expansion of some targeting measures to people in low SES groups through the language and literacy initiatives is the natural extension of the policy. To my mind, the institutions operating in the tertiary sector and the tertiary market have responded quickly and innovatively to the new policy settings and are in the vanguard of change. Unfortunately, it's governments that have lagged behind. While clear dates were set for implementation, much of the benefits of the tertiary sector was to be realised in the out years. TEXA was originally to be established fully by 2010 and integrated with the VET regulator in 2013. That was a commitment the Deputy Prime Minister gave at the Big Skills Conference in 2013. So we've made a good, if somewhat slow, start. And it is, I agree with Peter, imperative that consistent policy settings are in large part maintained and their outcomes are assessed before we go into some mad process of changing those. So the prospect of change of government at the next election and the lack of an explicit bipartisan commitment to the current policy settings risks throwing the overall strategy into some turmoil. So the inability of Labor governments to reach and agree on a reform agenda may prove to be the biggest hurdle to national reform and achievement. Australia has built an enviable tertiary sector, which has been assessed by the OECD as one of the leading systems in the world, both in a higher education perspective, if you look at their report in that area, and in vocational education and training. Consistent policy settings are critical for Australia to become a leader in a universal tertiary education system. And why we are trying to achieve that, I think the evidence is summarised in one particular graph, which is my favourite, shows basically the advantage to individuals accruing from participation in higher education or tertiary education, both at any point in their lifetime and over the lifespan. Thanks.
Well, thank you both very much indeed. We're just going to engage in a quick rearrangement of the furniture up front here. So I'm going to invite the two presenters to join us up at the front. I will moderate to the extent that that's required and now throw it open for any questions.
The Christopher Pine thought bubble that I'm speaking as UH chair here, that the GOH should be excluded from the TEXA arrangements. UA immediately wrote to him and suggested that he might just reflect on that, because I'm not sure whether it would be good for Australia for BHP or the Commonwealth Bank to be excused from APRA or ASIC, respectively. I just sent a note to Gavin. Trying to remember the name of the legislation. It was the Glass-Steagall legislation. One of the silliest decisions that Bill Clinton ever made was after being badgered for 6 years, he finally repealed the Glass-Steagall legislation, which was, the legislation introduced post-depression to protect the community in respect of the behaviour of banks and their behaviour investing in derivatives and matters I don't really know. And look how quickly that came home to roost. So I think, in all seriousness, regardless of the loftiness of institutions, it's important that there be a regulatory framework applying.
Thank you, Peter. Lisa. And I think there's a microphone working its way towards you.
I'm Lisa Wheelahan from the Martin Institute. I have a question for Professor Coldrake. Thank you for your presentation. I'm particularly interested in issues to do with the AQF. I think there's many, many, many reasons why having two regulators is a completely mad idea. And one of them you touched on, which is the AQF. I'm just wondering how you can reconcile your argument that the AQF should sit within TEXA when you also argued that the major problems were within VET. What would be the relationship between the AQF in TEXA and the VET regulator?
I was thinking of the... I mean, I understand those dimensions. I was particularly looking at the context of universities in terms of their intersection rather than the broader responsibilities of AQF. The broader point is that there is a great anxiety that, as you implied, that AQF sees itself as doing more than what was entertained when it was established. And I think some of the really difficult issues that we're going to have to deal with, particularly around master's qualifications, might well be issues that TEXA needs to have a look at and provide guidance on the reasonableness of behaviour. Now, some people would say UA's, including this guy, would say UA's copping out on that. I'm not sure, because I don't have a better idea, and we might need to think it through. But understand, I was actually giving a response which was a bit selfish to universities and their sectoral engagement.
This is actually a point that I agree with the UA position on. I think really, if we're going to try and progress this change, we really have to work on the assumption that TEXA will be the single national regulator from 2013. And if we move... diminish that outcome, then I think we set up a situation that's going to be very difficult in the longer run. I am a bit concerned that, according to Campus Review today, that Senator Cormann's now sort of said he loves the VET regulator and he's got no issues with it. I mean, to my mind, moving to a single national regulator for the system is absolutely the pivotal building block that we need to have. And unless and until we do it, we've got great problems. So I agree with Peter's overall comments around the AQF's seat and where it should sit, and I think the step should be to bring it into TEXA.
Yes.
I'm Margaret Mazzolini from Swinburne. Following on from Lisa's question, I guess, Peter, you said there was some slight concern about the AQF see coming under TEXA, and I assume that's from the governance point of view, that the body that would be setting one set of standards would be actually be part of the regulator enforcing them. Isn't there a more general danger there that we might get what we wish for in terms of TEXA or even DEWA then thinking that it can set both the learning and teaching and the research standards, especially if the ALTC exercise around learning and teaching standards doesn't come up with anything very usable?
Possibly. And that needs to be thought through with great care. I think our position... we also recognise that our position, as it were, is right now an impractical position. And it's therefore one that we're seeking to push to... I think it's one that we're seeking to push rather than be quite sure where it's going to end. But I think the simplicity of the system... I mean, those of us in this room might be engaged with these issues, but we're dealing with a sector where... with a community where the issues are really... are not daily and immediate issues. And I think we've just got to try and have a system that's understandable. But, I fully concede the vulnerabilities of our own position. I think I've said that from the beginning.
A question for each, if I can. Peter, I'm going to ask you an extra question. Have you seen a coalition policy or do you know if there's one coming out? But my real question is really about the international market, which you both talked about very well. I mean, we're now looking at a problem which is just getting bigger by the day. If there's a 20% drop in revenues going to higher education from international next year, which does seem possible, maybe that's a little high, but it does seem possible, that takes out about 3% of income overall, but it will be 5% or more in the institutions which you said were overexposed. I mean, they weren't overexposed until the government started changing immigration policy dramatically all at once, but they are overexposed now, yes. If in that situation, what would UA do? I mean, a substantial drop, say, registering on a, say, March, April of 3% plus across the system, I mean, that requires more than institution-by-institution responses. I mean, that requires something substantial. How would you go about dealing with that? Whoever's there, and neither party are at all interested in talking about this at the moment. My question for Jim is really also about international, but in another sense. I liked your use of the OECD thematic review. I think it's a really good report, very informative, and continues to be until the next one is done. And it's substantially deeper and better than anything we do. The present government was talking about international perspectives and comparisons a lot when it took power in 2007. I mean, mainly to make a point about funding and about the Howard government neglecting funding and so on. And there was this clear understanding, and not quite stated like this, but almost, that the government, new government, would restore the international comparability of Australian public sector funding. That rhetoric vanished without trace once the Bradley report was down. That there's been no discussion of the kind of international perspective ever since, none whatsoever coming out of, well, either side of politics. How do we kind of, do you think there's any prospect of getting those sorts of perspectives back on the agenda, getting that kind of larger thinking going again? Because it seems to me that unless we do, we have no benchmark for system improvement.
That's a really good question. And I have to, you know, I just need to be careful here because, you know, I was in the government at the time some decisions were made, so I need to sort of separate out what I know from what I think. Let me make a slightly scurrilous statement at the front end. That is, it seems to me that one of the things that's been proven is the international education sector can't be divided into this bit of VET and that bit of higher education. I mean, essentially, it is Australia which is actually selling an education system and putting that out into the international marketplace. And the wanton destruction of value of that industry, I think, is unbelievable. So to my mind, what I read, some of the things I left out of what I said, you know, Navitas, for example, which can operate across countries, is opening up in the United States, and it will, you know, shift students from one country to another. We've got a situation now where, again, to make a slightly scurrilous statement, I just wonder whether attracting students from South Asia in a way in which they choose to pay for their education, contribute to the economy of the country, come in an orderly fashion and seek to participate in an orderly migration process is somewhat better than what we have now, which is a rather disorderly process of boat arrivals of people coming in an uncoordinated way. And you might think they're not connected. I actually think they are. I absolutely think if you cut off the routes to immigration to this country entirely, then you actually do that. Do I think we can get it back in? I think it's inevitably going to come back on the table, because all the figures that I've seen show a disastrous drop in the intake of international students. It's either going to cause a funding crisis in the universities and the various providers. You've already seen it in some of the VET sector, where there's been a mixture of providers electing to take their capital elsewhere, you know, voluntarily just choosing to shut down, and others that have actually been closed just because of the, in some cases, inappropriate activity. So it just seems to me this is one of the big issues, and it's very difficult to get anybody to comment about it, and the subtext around the migration debate is very difficult, but there is no way, given the financial crisis that will hit that industry, and as I said, the wanton destruction of value as I see it, that the issue can't come back onto the political agenda.
I didn't know we had a migration debate. I thought it was a race to the bottom.
To answer the questions you asked me, on the coalition policy, I've simply trawled through every recent public statement that has been made by the shadow minister for higher education and anything else that I can work out. Now, the only surmise on everything I've said there, I've seen in black and white, the only thing I surmised was just, well, what happens if the capped system, the uncapped system, is challenged, and where does that go? And for a coalition government, you could see where that might go, differently to what a Labor government might respond to. That was only a surmise. On the international stuff, a few weeks ago, before the election was called, and before the migration debate, so-called, got as ugly as it did, but aware of the data that was coming through and the seriousness of that data, and I'm sure other people were reflecting the same stuff, following meeting with the Diwa folk about it, particularly, I think, David Hazlehurst at an early briefing, I went and saw the head of the Department of Immigration. And we agreed that after the election, whatever happens, that there ought to be a serious discussion involving UA, Foreign Affairs, DISA, DIWA, you know, trade, Treasury, finance, the lot, to just get our heads collectively around this. We recognise that nothing could happen in this period, but I'm sure within about 2 weeks of the election there'll have to be some sort of serious discussion about it. So people are, he's certainly very aware of it. I also think the university sector will have to listen to what advice departments give the sector about practices in the sector, in our part of the sector, which might have led the sector to suffer some collateral comment or collateral damage of its own. Because we all sort of say it's the problem is elsewhere, but there are some issues on our side of the line. And when I did meet the Secretary of the Department, he shared a couple of those. And we said, well, we need to share those and talk about those with colleagues. And I'm sure we'll be doing that when we meet at this university in later September.
Yes.
Target of 20% of enrolments coming from SES households. There's a big variation in the different institutions, as we saw there. I'm just wondering how they're planning to achieve this. Are they going to use the American-style affirmative action or quota system? And is there any... You talk about performance funding. Is there any penalty on funding if they fail to achieve this? Is there real incentive to do this? I mean, surely the university is going to have to be proactive to achieve this, aren't they?
Yes, I suppose what I was saying is that unlike a lot of the other funding that came through, the HEP, the Higher Education Participation Funding, is both a combination of reward funding and incentive funding. So from the graph that I put up, you will have seen that quite a number of institutions in Australia at the time of the review actually had already hit the 20% target, and some exceeded it by quite a margin. Those institutions are, in fact, the institutions that are benefiting in the first round of funding. And, in fact, the idea behind that was that some of those funds actually helped defray the costs of those institutions in achieving that target. At the same time, it's set in place an incentive for other institutions that fall below the 20% to decide what they want to do about that. And as I tried to kind of perhaps poorly say, the debate before the equity targets and the debate after the equity targets has sort of changed a bit. People are really trying to work out where they fit into that. Look, I don't know whether it's a good idea whether Monash tries to hit the equity target. You know, I just really don't know whether that's a sound business decision for some institutions. I think probably a sound business decision for an institution like Monash might be to think through what it's going to do with its Berwick and Frankston campuses and the growth corridors and how it might partner with other organisations to actually hit some of those targets. So the answer is no, there won't be any national affirmative action approach. But I think what it has unleashed, and I think has been incredibly positive, has been institutions really looking at their missions and what they're trying to achieve and really thinking through what they can do to hit some of those equity targets. I personally don't think that everyone should have to, you know, but I think there are some incentives. they should be encouraged to find ways in which, in a kind of collective or partnership way, that they can share that task with others.
Surely institutions should look firstly at their own communities from which they draw, and that supports your position. It will be difficult with postcodes and so on for the ANU and the University of Canberra to do anything. I mean, or to do much. I mean, they probably will be able to do something. But an institution, now speaking as VC of QUT, like my own, I mean, our current low SES figure is about 14. We've sort of said if we get to 17 by 2020, that's actually quite a stretch given our big demography and by the fact that we've in the last 10 years closed two non-performing suburban campuses, though we have one in the growth corridor, which will be very helpful. But I think it's not a question of simply looking at the growth corridor, it's a question of looking at the Brisbane population. And if you bring that down not merely to the broader SES definition but to the Indigenous population, 2% of people who live in Brisbane are Indigenous. We have 1.4% Indigenous students in our university. So we're sort of not doing our bit, is my view, and we work harder to do our bit. The good thing is that we have a high retention rate, but I'd like to maintain the retention rate while increasing the commencings. But I think I don't think too many institutions should be walking away. There may be particular challenges with an ANU or a University of Canberra, but I don't think for many there's a good reason to walk away.
Gavin.
Jim, I'd like to ask you about a tertiary education system. And let's put ourselves at 2015 and let's posit that the TESCA is operating well and that VET is in with higher education in Victoria and Western Australia, have decided to join the rest of the country. Let's be sort of idealistic about this. What would be your next moves to establish a tertiary education system? Would you be having, for example, the Australian government taking over funding of diplomas and above? Or some folk are sort of very nervous about the idea of an undifferentiated system, and our colleagues in TAFE Directors Australia, for example, want to have five tiers or sectors inserted, and some vice-chancellors, including my own, want to have their own tiering. Would you be doing that, or would you be doing something else?
Hopefully I wouldn't have... That's right. Hopefully I don't have to wait till 2015. What would I think it looked like? I think that one of the most compelling things that I've seen over the last few years was, again, something Glyn Davis put up, AFR seminar some years ago, which was the bunching of Australian universities in one type against the Carnegie Mellon classification. Everybody wanted to be the same. And I think that, not everybody can't be the same. And I think one of the things we actually have to try and do in a tertiary system is actually value diversity and not sort of say that because this is that, that's better than that. It's just different. You know, there may be a need for a technology university. There may be a need for a really research-intensive university in the sciences. That's fine. There may also need to be a provider which focuses on bridging skills out of the kind of vocational education system into higher education qualifications. I suppose my answer to that is the funding system should be Commonwealth. That there should, certainly down to diploma level, that the funding mechanisms that apply should be the same for all providers. I mean, I can see that there's an argument, which personally I don't agree with, that below that it should be different. But I can set that aside. But I think that with the AQF, anything from diploma and above should have the same kind of funding regime. People should be able to access the same kind of loan schemes. There should be the same government-supported places, arrangements in place. So I think that's important. I think that's a better solution than TAFE's trying to run and become higher education providers so they can get government-supported places, which is a bit what's happening at the moment. I suppose I'm going for variety of service type, different organisations with different missions, allowing organisations to form partnerships which make sense to reach the kind of things that you want to do, and a quality of access for students around income support, which they've basically got now, and also in terms of access to government-supported places. I think that's really where we need to get to. I could push beyond that, but I won't, because I don't think that's going to happen by 2015.
We might need to have further evidence of a failure regulation in order to get to some of the states over the line. But we've had the failure regulation. I mean, and Bradley was pre Indian students crisis.
Picking up on Gavin's comments, it's actually a key issue. If you're actually going to talk about creation of diversity in the sector, which we certainly have for many years talked about the significance of diversity and the importance of having different types of institutions, we have yet to go anywhere near establishing a structure or funding process which in any way values diversity. There is no esteem attached to it. I mean, let's see the first university to put up its hands and say, actually, we don't want to be a research university. We actually want to be deeply embedded in our local community. And so we don't have a structure that does that. So what would be the processes that you would, and policies and funding initiatives that you would put in place that would actually support diversity rather than essentially punishing diversity, which is essentially what the current funding framework does?
Look, I'm not going to be able to give you a quick answer to that question. Let me say this, though. You know, I recognise what Gavin has alluded to. That is, an awful lot of the discretionary funding in the system actually comes through the research grant process, as flawed as that process is. And it's, of late, come through the EIF process as well. You know, where, in fact, you've been able to get quite substantial capital funds which have actually enabled you to offset expenditure in other areas. It seems to me that giving students access to the same income support and access to government-supported places regardless of where the institution sits is really important. One of the things that Bradley Report came out on a certain position, which was that a university is not a university if it doesn't do research, and I think in subsequent comments, I think Denise Bradley's been quite strong on that. I think that surprised a lot of people. I think some people really anticipated there might be a shift in that position, but it's not at the moment. But my guess is at some point somebody's going to have to reassess that. And that's not to say that staff in institutions which aren't research institutions won't do research. But it may be to say to give greater value and greater reward to the research, to the learning and teaching, and the kind of creation of pathways for students in outer metropolitan areas and rural areas, which the partnership between some universities and TAFE is the logical way to go, particularly in Victoria and Queensland.
No, a lot of the interesting tests here will be in the regional areas, where vice chancellors are seeking to keep their institutions together. You look at the challenges that are being met by the new vice chancellor of Central Queensland University, where he has recognised that the way in which he can provide educational opportunity and satisfy aspiration in Central Queensland is, apart from liking Rockhampton, and I don't make that as a light comment. I mean, he's engaged, he's re-engaged his university with the local area, and started to rebuild some trust and confidence that it's all serious. But the other thing that he's done is to recognise that the only chance in terms of the aspiration issues is to link up formally with Vet TAFE. And he's doing it. He's doing it without apology. He's encountering a bit of resistance domestically, but he's just going to have to charge through it, and he will.
Sharon.
Sharon Winokur from the Business Higher Education Roundtable. I guess I'm wondering whether part of the diversity is whether TAFE institutes will then be offering degrees, and if that's going to be the case, is that okay? And then the next step might even be beginning of research programs in TAFE institutes, and what impact will that have on universities?
I personally like the model. A lot of people didn't like the model. I personally like the model that Victoria's pursued, and that's happened in Charles Darwin. And I think what's really CQU are doing, and if they had their way, they'd probably do it with some governance changes as well, which may be a bit difficult in Queensland. I actually think that does provide a framework within which you can actually move people through from vet pathways to higher education pathways, but maintain, and this is where I agree with Ian Young and his comments at the last session, that whilst maintaining the quality of the higher education provision. And I think that's actually fundamentally important. So the original policy position in Victoria, I know because I was the Deputy Secretary here at the time when Minkowski was Minister, was that TAFEs would offer higher education courses in areas which universities didn't and which were kind of developing exploratory areas. And it seemed to me there was quite a lot of rationale to that. The one where you say that we now create kind of polytechnics, if you like, for want of a better word, that are kind of across the sector, I'm less enamoured of personally. I doubt personally whether the Commonwealth is ever going to provide government-supported places to those entities anyway, so that will create some issues. But again, my preference is to actually create the environment where people are happy to sit where they sit, and you value and recognise that. And I do think the dual sector solution, despite some problems with the administrative, you know, different administrative arrangements in different sectors, really offers a solution that we haven't quite explored as much as we need to. And I am quite heartened by the work that Ian's done, and also RMIT, and also Ballarat is trying a different model, not necessarily, you know, it's a model they're putting forward in VU. So, I think there's room for experimentation in that space, but I do really agree with Ian that we need to look at maintaining the quality of the university offering, the higher education offering.
Look, the only comment I'd make is Queensland has very little experience in dual sector, and the sort of things that might be thought about in regional context in Queensland, particularly CQU, are things that we'll watch and I'm sure be guided by what's happening in Victoria. But let's be realistic here. There will be a limit to public funding capacity, and governments, whatever their colour, will make some choices about that. It just seems to me that some of the aspirations of certain of the vet players in this state in particular aren't being reasonably questioned or contained. And perhaps it's legitimate to do so. I'm not, I'm not close to these matters, but I mean, there is a limit to the public funding capacity. Let's be honest about it. There'd be some who would argue that it's spread too widely now, but it is actually quite hard outside the G8 to be a high-impact research player. The only prospect you have of that, Ian knows this, I know this, others, is to invest very heavily, as deeply as a G8 does, in the areas in which you want to make a mark. So the only path is to be extraordinarily selective in your investments. And once you build up strength, you can spread it a bit. But you've got to get that that body of work in place first.
Yeah. Thank you. Picking up on the issues of diversity and system coordination, I couldn't agree more than what Jim has been saying about funding of programs and the like. But isn't the logical consequence of that that we actually need to get, and that's getting back to one of your slides, a coordinated approach by both the federal and the state governments on planning of higher education provision, missions and the like, which may be complex, but I mean, the way compact negotiations are playing out at the moment, it's a one-sided argument. And if we talk about a tertiary sector, wouldn't it make more sense, even though it is more complex, to actually move into a concerted effort from both the Commonwealth and the states in terms of what our sector should look like in probably 5 to 10 years?
Well, I think the answer to that's, obviously yes. I mean, change only happens in Australia when that engagement occurs. I suppose the debate in Australia really is one about whether, in fact, the Australian government should take over the full funding responsibility for tertiary education. And my sense is that would be the end point that you should aim for. state, the debate that we've had recently around health costs and pressures on state budgets. The reality is, when you sit in a state department, whether it's DIRT or education and training or whatever, the pressures are around school funding. That's where the pressures are, and that's where the political pressure is. And it is always, in my experience, you are always at the end of the line in terms of either funding for capital or funding for new things. And the sense that the state can continue to run a purchase place model and always constantly seeking money from the Commonwealth in order to do that and supplement the money that they spend, I think is just not a viable strategy going forward for a state government. And in fact, inevitably creates the situation where I think the TAFEs will lose out. And so if my view is, if you actually support a strong TAFE system, you actually have to support the shift of the funding of the TAFE system to the federal government. You cannot leave it to die and wither within a kind of constrained state funding environment.
I mean, I think I don't disagree with that. But in terms of the states, and I do come from the state of Queensland, which, like the state of Victoria, has benefited from significant investment in research and education. States also, unless states in 50 or 100 years are to be other than postboxes, states need to think about their own strategic directions. Education and research has been part of that thinking in at least two jurisdictions. And I think that's certainly, I can speak for Queensland, has been to the great benefit in terms of the challenge our state had in having a very narrow economic base 20 years ago. There is an issue here wanting to have it both ways. I mean, we understand the funding and policy traffic and its direction, but I do think if states are to have a significant role themselves, then they need to actually be given some encouragement. I do note that in today's Courier Mail, the mayors of North Queensland have decided that it would be a good idea, or some of them have decided it would be a good idea to have a separate state. I mean, this always gets trotted out. It's like the Redcliffe. It's like the Redcliffe Railway. the new state for North Queensland idea is one of the last refuges that is indulged in. It'll pass in a fortnight, thankfully.
Any other questions? Well, if not, I might just invoke the chair's privilege and ask one of my own, if that's all right. And it's to do with TEXA and what it signifies in terms of the relationship between universities and the state, if I can use that term, because there might be two ways of reading this. One is that it's simply a kind of an administrative reorganisation of regulatory authority into one pair of hands as opposed to many, and thereby setting up possibilities for bringing different sectors together. And after all, a lot of the regulations that are at stake have been, as you said, Peter, around with us for a while, such as the AQF. We just haven't been noticing them as much, perhaps, as we should. That might be one reading. Another reading could be that this actually marks quite a significant shift, and that the tradition of autonomy and self-accreditation is now shifting to one in which universities can only do things if they are licensed to do so by a state regulatory agency. And I think that's one way of viewing the scuffle around the AQF, that was sort of what was at stake in a way, around the nomenclature issue. So I'm just wondering two questions, I suppose. One is, which of those narratives is the right one in your view? And if it's the latter, that we are actually seeing an epochal shift, why? What's the case for it?
Okay, you go first on that one.
I probably have two different responses. I think that there is a greater level of collective agitation within UA about that, particularly the second, your proposition, than I might hold personally as a VC. Perhaps it's because I've worked in government. But I'm actually not as concerned as many that compacts will limit us. I don't have any problem with the notion of universities being expected to operate
efficiently and use the public resources well and look after their students properly and to be held accountable for that, primarily through their own universities and the self-governing nature of our organisations. And I realise the cohabitation of all those things is quite complex, but we live in a complex world and I'm fairly relaxed about this. But I do sense there's a very significant level of concern amongst colleagues about some of these issues. I was on the Hoare Committee, the Higher Education Management Review Committee. I don't know why I get asked to do things that people hate, but I was on this in 1995, where we actually made recommendations regarding modern governance and management universities, and we seem to be a bunch of fruit loops. Well, what's happened since? Most of Hoare recommendations have been implemented over a period of time. Why? Because universities had a bit of catching up to do. And I think, in a sense, if we're hoping to maintain and increase the level of public investment and confidence in us, then we've got to be a bit relaxed about a sensible level of accountability. And I recognise the risk of micro-control and management. I fear that as much as anyone. But I think our job is to work really closely with the authorities and try and... to complain is one thing, but I think we've got to engage with that really closely is another. The other comment I've made is a slight segue, relates to a discussion at my own senior staff retreat a couple of months ago, and Simon's been to these sort of occasions, where there was a lot of anxiety being provided about around standards and these sorts of issues. And I said to them, look, ignore it all. Ignore it all. What you've got to be worried about is the quality of what you're doing in the classroom, the quality of the endeavour of the research, and all those things. Because if you do all those things, the standards will be fine. So in other words, there has to be a natural disengagement by most staff members with what actually is being talked about. But I'm probably less troubled than a lot, and perhaps I'm naive, I hope not.
I don't really think I wanted to add anything to what Peter said. I think just maybe there was an awful lot of noise about the ineffectiveness of ALCA before the Bradley Review and a lot of concerns about the model, and I can recall several senior vice chancellors really talking about the need for standards against which quality would be assessed and the toothless tiger that was ALCA. My sense is the review has really formed a balanced position in relation to that. Though I agree with Peter, the thing to be concerned about is that we don't... I mean, I think it's important we have a single regulatory regime, but I think it's really important that we resist the temptation to stray into meddling into the business of institutions rather than setting standards that, you know, universities are, and higher education providers are happy to be assessed against and held accountable for. But there is always that risk. But I suppose I've weighed that up in the end and think probably the direction we're going is the preferable one.
Good. Well, look, on everyone's behalf, could I just offer our warmest thanks to you both for not just stimulating presentations, but some fantastic answers to the really great questions that have been asked. And invite everyone here to thank our presenters in the traditional way. Thank you both very much indeed.